We are men of science, Holmes.
We return once again to the most famous fictional address in the world, 221B Baker Street. We walk up the 17 steps and we visit the many iterations of a certain consulting detective and his Boswell, Dr. John H. Watson. It's the world of Sherlock Holmes with the Baker Street Babes. It's all new and all blue, just like a carbuncle. Next.
So, Dave, what is a carbuncle?
A carbuncle is a gemstone that is usually red, as I recall. But in the case of the Sherlock Holmes story, the blue carbuncle, it's blue. And it's like a big, giant gemstone, like a diamond. And there's a very famous story, the blue carbuncle, set around Christmas time. And I don't want to give too many plot details away, but it's a great first story to read. It's one I read every year at Christmas. It's wonderful. You have a glass of Petri wine, a little glass of port by the fire, read the blue carbuncle on Christmas Eve. That's what we Sherlockians do. And so this week, we continue our conversation with the Baker Street Babes about all things Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson. And we're going to continue our conversation with Ashley Polasek. She's got a PhD and specializes in adaptations of Sherlock Holmes, especially film and screen adaptations. So she uses this as a way to use the literary aspects of Sherlock Holmes to reach her students. You know, there's so many faces of Sherlock, the actors, you know, the famous ones and perhaps some less so that portrayed him. Can you give us some of the real highlight actors that, you know, are the most outstanding actors that played Sherlock Holmes?
I think if you're going to do a who's who of famous actors who've played Holmes, you're going to get a different list. But I would say the more important list is the sort of most iconic interpreters of the character. And that list is going to include, to begin with, William Gillette, who we think of as the sort of first most important impersonator of the character, who penned the play Sherlock Holmes with Conan Doyle's blessing. It premiered in 1899, and it was recorded, or it was filmed, not on stage, but it was like adapted for screen as a silent film in 1916. That was a long thought lost film, but was recently rediscovered 2014 and was restored. You can get that on DVD, actually. It's wonderful.
And he's been played with a lot. Can you give us a sense of, you know, how ubiquitous this character is in pop culture?
Oh, my word. I mean, he holds the Guinness Book of World Records record for the single most adapted human literary character of all time. And he exists across all genres. So, you know, musical Sherlock Holmes, it's been done. Is there a ballet? Yes, there is. Are you going to see it in anime? Sure. Disney animated film? Yep. Action adventure. You know, there obviously are straight mysteries, but it goes into film noir, bordering on hard-boiled. Really just across genre. If you'd look, he's moved around in time. So you want Sherlock Holmes, who's been frozen and thawed and is now in the 1980s, you can have that. If you want, you know, future Sherlock Holmes, you can have Sherlock Holmes in the 22nd century. If you want today's Sherlock Holmes, you can have BBC Sherlock or CBS's Elementary. We can gender bend the characters. We can make them in different countries. It doesn't matter. And it's wonderful, the kind of elasticity and staying power that these characters really have.
Well, back to our list. We go Gillette, and then I would suppose a certain, what, Basil Rathbone?
Basil Rathbone would be the next really important one, I would say. He's Sherlock Holmes for an entire generation, and probably still Sherlock Holmes for a lot of people. Rathbone first played Sherlock Holmes on screen in 1939 in The Hound of the Baskervilles. And he did another 13 films after that, and I think several hundred radio episodes. And he was really important, particularly because he was the first Sherlock Holmes that was consciously put back in the Victorian period. So we tend to think of Holmes as Victorian, and when we make him modern, it's some big, exciting thing. But actually, it was the it was the kind of standard that he was always modernized, because Conan Doyle wrote him as a contemporary figure, and he started being on screen while the character was still being written by Conan Doyle. And so in the 1920s, you have Sherlock Holmes in a modern office with secretaries and dictaphones. You have him fighting gangsters with Tommy guns. And then in 1939, they decided we're going to reproduce the 19th century on screen, and we're going to make Holmes Victorian. And even though 12 out of Rathbone's 14 films are recontemporized, he's in the 1940s, he's fighting Nazis, really, that set the standard. And from that point on, the public really expected Sherlock Holmes to be Victorian. And so that's what we think of as Sherlock Holmes, sort of walking the gaslit cobblestone streets of London. That's, we have Rathbone to thank for that.
And also, we should not forget Watson, which was Nigel Bruce, and portrayal of Watson, which is very different in the films from the one that we read.
That's true. Nigel Bruce's Watson is he's kind of a bumbling character. However, up until he appeared on screen, no Watson had ever got top billing. That is, no Watson had ever appeared in the opening credits of a film. He'd always been treated like an incidental character, the sort of character who would appear in one case and then disappear. Nigel Bruce became an integral part of a team, Holmes and Watson, and we still think of them as Holmes and Watson. You can't really have one without the other. They're really interdependent. And even though Bruce didn't really play the Watson that we recognize from the stories, he's actually a very capable person, he still elevated Watson to this vital position, and he hasn't really diminished from that. In fact, he's grown and improved since then as a character to really become the hero of the stories, arguably, at this point. If you really want sort of fairly faithfully reproduced versions of the canonical stories kind of brought to life, and not to say that there aren't liberties taken, obviously there are. You're only going to get the stories if you read the stories, but Brett is
as close as you're going to get.
Perhaps as close as you're going to get. I mean, his performance is quite mannered, and Brett himself as a person was a very interesting fellow, and he was, you know, fairly mannered himself. But his performance is wonderful. He's very in command of the space. You get a lot of the sense of the depth of the character because he brings in qualities like Holmes's humor, his sense of humor, and his testiness, that is, you know, when he gets irritated, but also his love of his Watson and his kind of big heart. All of those qualities are in there.
That's one of the things I enjoyed about that series is, to me, you know, at the very core of the Sherlock Holmes experience is the relationship between Sherlock Holmes and John Watson.
Absolutely. And I would say it's fair to make the argument that the Brett series really cemented that. That's about the time, late 70s, early 80s to mid 80s. That's about the time when adaptations were having Watson start to be kind of have an interdependence. So it wasn't so much a sidekick as like a life partner. And we see that now. I mean, if you took away Martin Freeman's Watson from Benedict Cumberbatch's Holmes, the Holmes would fall apart. The same thing with Jude Law and Robert Downey Jr. The same thing with Lucy Liu and Johnny Lee Miller. I mean, they absolutely need each other. And I think that friendship and that love is evident in the Jeremy Brett series.
And just to share with you, I think my favorite Jeremy Brett, Edward Hardwick moment when Edward Hardwick was playing Watson was is from The Hound of the Baskervilles. And they're in an old coal mine, and he's been hiding out from Watson. Watson doesn't know he's been there, and he discovers that yes, this is where Holmes has been, you know, investigating this mystery, and Holmes offers him some stew, and he says, you know, try my stew, and Watson looks at it and says, it's disgusting, Holmes.
It is disgusting.
Yes.
And,
yes, it is.
Jeremy
Still
Brett goes,
it's better when it's
yes.
hot. It's like one of the most hilarious lines ever. It's just, you can see, it really is disgusting. But I that's, to me, where their characters are just so real.
Yes. Yes, I agree. I love that moment, too.
Tell us a bit about, what do you think about the popular BBC Sherlock series? What have they done really that has ignited the interest that it just blew up Twitter when that was on recently.
Yeah, I mean, I think they've done a lot of things very well. They've re-harnessed a lot of the sort of love and interest. It is it's challenging in that you only have three episodes every couple years, but of course each one of them is basically a movie, and so that allows the fan interest to kind of be sustained over the course of, it's been 7 years now. And I think what they really started with was a fundamental love of all things Sherlock Holmes. So they didn't start with the intention to, oh, we're going to make something that is canonical, or, oh, we want to make something that is weird and avant-garde. What they did was they declared everything is canon. Stephen Moffat and Mark Gatiss, who are the co-creators and showrunners, they bonded over particularly a mutual love of the updated, the 1940s set Basil Rathbone films. So not the ones set in the Victorian period, but particularly the ones that are more or less B movies where he's fighting Nazis. And those films tend to be much maligned for being, you know, low budget and produced very quickly. And people are, they get their back up sometimes about them not being faithful to the source text, whatever that may mean. But the idea that those are the ones they loved really show in what I think they finally produce, which is kind of a love affair with everything that Sherlock Holmes is to people. And it incorporates all sorts of different aspects of what people love about the characters. And so it doesn't get bogged down really with, well, we have to do it this way, or we have to make sure we get that reference in, or we have to make sure that he dresses this way, or that he, you know, that the set looks this particular way. They get to play around a lot, and they've more or less made a big sandbox, and they just play in it, and you can feel the joy that everybody who is part of the show has in making it. And I think that really is where its success is.
Well, and I can just say from personal experience, when I was teaching a summer school class for at-risk kids, and you know, wanted to give them some exposure to these wonderful characters and use Holmes as an example of the scientific method and a way of using deductive reasoning and, you know, applying those principles of, you make observations and then you come up with a hypothesis and you test it and then you see if it's right. And so I showed them some of the old Jeremy Brett series, and they were okay with that. But when I showed them A Study in Pink, right? Yeah, mm-hmm. Study in Pink. They were just enthralled and hooked, and they wanted to see more and more and more. So it's definitely a great access point for young people today.
It is, because it takes all the ephemera that they're used to for their own process of observing the world. So it's one thing to make a deduction about somebody's pocket watch, but your students and my students don't carry pocket watches. However, when those same deductions are made about somebody's cell phone, the light bulb goes on and they go, oh, mm-hmm. That's the world I live in. These are the things that surround me. This is where I can make my observations and I can learn about the world in the same way. So I think that too is particularly helpful as an access point for millennials, certainly.
For your students and for everybody, what is it about this world and these characters that drives you as an educator to help them understand them?
I think that there are so many ways that Sherlock Holmes can be used to teach different subjects. So you use the character to teach the scientific method, which is wonderful. I'm an English teacher, so my students delve into the canon and we can do literary analysis. We watch adaptations. We do a weekly screening when I teach my home seminar. And not only do they get to see, they learn about the process of adaptation, but they also can get some of film history, which is wonderful. They can see the difference between, for instance, a television program that's produced in the 1980s where there are sets, but they're basically done on film and it's all edited together, versus television in Britain in the 1960s, where it's all produced as if it's live, the difference in the way that's produced. So that's something that they can learn about culturally. I have friends who variously utilize Sherlock Holmes to teach aspects of theater, geography. Fan studies certainly is a big one. I mean, the Sherlock Holmes fan community is robust, and it has a very long history. So culture studies and fan studies certainly have a lot to gain from looking at Sherlock Holmes. I think that it touches so many different areas that it's a wonderful tool.
And before we let you go, what about some of the more off the wall, different takes on Sherlock Holmes, like animated versions? And you know, there's so many that are non-canonical. Hit on a few of those that are might be some of your favorites that you cover in your class.
Sure. I would say if you're going to watch animated, you cannot do better than Disney's The Great Mouse Detective, which came out in 1985. And it's just absolutely wonderful, based on the Eve Titus books, Basil of Baker Street. And you have a great villain in Professor Radigan, who's voiced by Vincent Price. Absolutely wonderful. And it was made by Ron Clements and John Musker, who are responsible for The Little Mermaid and Aladdin, also known as My Childhood. In fact, they're up for an Oscar this year for Moana, so they're still doing wonderful work. That's an absolutely wonderful, joyful film to watch. There are plenty of different Sherlock Holmes films that, for one reason or the other, are slightly lesser well-known. There was a pair of films, Hound of the Baskervilles and Sign of Four, that was done at the same time the Jeremy Brett series was being produced. And because of a copyright dispute between the two production studios, they didn't make any more other than those two. But they star Ian Richardson, who was absolutely wonderful as Francis Urquhart in the British miniseries House of Cards. That's what the Kevin Spacey program is based on. So those are well worth seeing. And I would say that also don't necessarily neglect non-screen versions. So one of my all-time favorite Holmes adaptations is a radio dramatization series done by the BBC, headed by Bert Cools, who is a lovely man. And that is the only version where the same actors have done the entire canon. And they're fully dramatized radio programs. You can download them on iTunes. They're worth absolutely every penny. And one episode will get you to work and back, and they just make you feel good all day. So I'd recommend those absolutely.
You're listening to Blue Dot on North State Public Radio. And when we come back, we'll continue our look at the world of Sherlockia with the Baker Street Babes. And we'll be talking to Amy Thomas. And we're back, and we're talking to Amy C. Thomas. She's one of the Baker Street Babes, and we're talking about the world of Sherlock Holmes and Dr. John H. Watson, created by Arthur Conan Doyle over a century ago. How did you first encounter the Sherlock Holmes characters? When did you first become interested in this world?
My formative memory would have been around age 9 or 10, I believe, and I recall getting an audiobook out of the library of some of the stories, and what I most remember is listening to the Speckled Band and just being completely freaked out by it. I was so creeped out, and it just made me, I was creeped out, but I really wanted to learn more, and I was so intrigued by the character, and from there I listened to several more on audio, and then I read several more of the stories, and became a fan at an early age. And through my teens, I was really connected to the world of Holmes through the books by Laurie R. King. She writes the Mary Russell and Sherlock Holmes books, which are really amazing, and really, they have a very feminine voice in them, and I really love those as well.
Those take place in Holmes' later years after Watson, and he actually winds up marrying Mary Russell, right?
Yes, that's correct. So they are definitely controversial in that way, but Mary Russell herself is a Holmes-like character. She's very intelligent and she's very witty. And as a young woman, she was a great window into a world that in many ways had felt very masculine to me as a child, reading these stories about these two men.
Let's talk briefly about your work with social media. That's one of your main tasks with the Baker Street Babes. What? Tell me about the world of tweeting and Facebook for you guys.
We really love interacting with other Sherlockians. I mean, that is something that is just so much fun. And it gives us an opportunity to kind of say our piece, but also see other people's opinions and what they love and what they hate and interact and just bring, hopefully bring this world together. We generally see like episodes of things like BBC Sherlock before US broadcast, whether we see them during UK broadcast or we have advanced copies or we go to screenings or whatever. So it's really fun to live tweet and watch as plot points kind of hit the screen and people react in the moment. Whether we're expecting a reaction or not, it's interesting to see what people do. And we get so much joy, whether people love or hate something, from just being part of the conversation. And being able to hopefully, like I had said earlier, bring together disparate groups of people, older people, younger people, everybody in between, to kind of just, in that moment, watch something together, enjoy something together.
Let's talk about the world of Sherlockians. You're very active in social media. Tell us what are Baker Street Irregulars?
The Baker Street Irregulars are one of the original gatherings of Sherlock Holmes fans, and alongside them comes the Adventuresses of Sherlock Holmes. The Irregulars began in 1934 as an all-male organization. And the Adventuresses began in 1968 as an all-female organization, and both of them are now gender inclusive. They gather in New York City in January each year, and they mark the birthday of Sherlock Holmes, which is observed on January 6th. And both of those societies obviously have been going for many years, and the Adventuresses in some ways arose in somewhat of a reaction to the Baker Street Irregulars obviously being an all-male society and women wanting to be involved and in some cases even picketing the BSI dinner and doing kind of their own organization as well.
What do you think it is about these characters that were set originally in Victorian England that speaks to us so much now?
You know, that is an excellent question, and I think it's that wherever you look, Holmes is a man out of his time. I think, you know, when you read the canon, you're talking about someone who was bohemian. He's described by Watson as this man who is kind of living his own life on his own terms, and it just is wherever he is, whether it's 1895 or 2017, he stands out from the crowd. And he solves mysteries, but as a character, he himself is a mystery. And I think that just continues to make him kind of, if someone's automatically out of their own time, they can be placed kind of in any time. I mean, we have there's a futuristic cartoon that places him, I believe in the 22nd or 23rd century. And it's like, I think Watson might be
a robot,
yeah. If I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. And those are pretty wild. They're animated, they're for kids, but they're fun. It's the amazing to me. Ashley was telling us previously that the Sherlock Holmes character is the most portrayed character in all of literature.
Yes.
Which is astonishing.
Yes. And yeah. I think, like I was saying before, the fact that they are, for the most part, short stories means that there's so much that isn't told. And that's like an irresistible invitation to writers, adapters, directors, whoever you are artists even to fill in those blanks of what we don't see happening and to kind of, you know, put in those details that Doyle didn't have time to give us because he's getting to these plots so quickly because he is working in such a short form medium.
Can you tell us just a little bit about the final episode, the final problem? Because there was a lot of vitriol thrown around about that. What was it like being involved in the Twitter war revolved around the last episode of Sherlock on BBC and PBS?
Definitely, you are correct that it has been controversial. I mean, obviously, to the point that even Mark Gatiss addressed kind of the issues surrounding it recently. But as far as the vitriol goes, I think any show that's as internationally popular as Sherlock is, with the amount of anticipation that hiatuses this long create, is bound to carry a huge weight of expectations and a lot of hopes for every episode, especially when you only have, you know, 3 episodes a season. Obviously, no show is perfect and no episode can please everyone in a fandom, especially one as diverse as the Sherlock audience. For us, ultimately, we appreciate the care that goes into making Sherlock and the creator's vision, but it doesn't define who Sherlock Holmes is for us. It's the brainchild of one group of people. What we say to people who might be disappointed is that Sherlock Holmes is a lot bigger than one show. He's been around for over 100 years, and he's still going strong on film, on TV, in web series, radio plays, stage plays, visual art, print, anything you're into, there's always more of Sherlock Holmes. And whether you're sad Sherlock is over for the time being, or you're angry at how it ended, there's always something else for you to look at, watch, read, listen to, and you can even write your own. So I think it's, you know, ultimately we have our opinions and we try to be as even-handed as possible, but every adaptation of Sherlock Holmes is just one person's adaptation or a few people's, and the character transcends any adaptation that's ever been made. He's a lot bigger than that.
Yes, and I'm sure he'll be around a century from now.
Absolutely.
So before I let you go, can I be a Baker Street Babe godfather?
Absolutely. Normally, we're the ones asking the questions that make someone an honorary babe, but we will make an exception for you. We have made a lot of people honorary babes since our inception in 2011, and we will happily add you to our ever-expanding list of our amazing Sherlockian friends.
That made me just amazingly happy. I could even sing. Thanks to our guests today, the Baker Street Babes, featuring Ashley Polasek and Amy Thomas. You can link to their website and Twitter and Facebook accounts at mynspr.org. Blue Dot's a production of North State Public Radio, and it's engineered by Mr. Nolan Ford, who, you know, Nolan, you shamed me a couple weeks ago when you wanted me to sing to
the Pink Floyd song.
Pink Floyd's, yeah, We Don't Need No Education. And I didn't do it because I just froze, so I wanted to make it up to you.
Okay.
So I'm going to sing you a song.
Okay, let's hear
it. But I wrote something especially for this episode.
Oh, great.
You ready?
Yeah, ready.
I love the Baker Street Babes and their Sherlockian ways. Ashley and Amy and Dr. Delacova, they're as bright as a galactic supernova. If this year I'm to mentally survive, it's because my mind's in Doyle's London circa 1895. Nolan Ford put me on the spot, so I remind you that from deep space we all live on a... Don, I forgot. Oh, that's it, a pale blue...